Over a career spanning half a century, Antigone Kefalla has published some 15 books across a number of different genres, three works of short fiction, The First Journey in 1975, The Island in 1984, and Summer Visit, three novellas in 2002. She's published two works of non-fiction, Sydney Journals, 2008, and Late Journals, 2022. The poetry collections The Alien, 1973, Thirsty Weather, 1978, European Notebook in 1988, and Absence, New and Selected Poems in 1992. Her most recent collection, Fragments, was published in 2016 and won the prestigious Judith Wright Calanthe Poetry Award. She's also written and published a children's book, Alexia, A Tale of Two Cultures. I spoke to Antigone Kefalla about her books, her experiences, and her conceptions of poetry and prose in Sydney in March 2021. Antigone, I thought I would start by just mapping out your chronology, if you like, or your trajectory, because you've been through
a lot of countries, yeah.
So just tell me, when were you in Braila? You were born and raised in Braila.
Yeah.
So how long were you there for?
We were there till we left in 45.
So how old were you when you left?
I was nearly 16.
Oh, you were quite old already.
Yeah, you were an adolescent.
And then,
oh, yes, I went to school there. I went even to high school after that. And so, yeah. My entire education was actually Romanian-based to a certain extent. And Greek was coming only as a sort of, you know, angle on one side from my father and I don't know what. But and then we left for Greece, yeah.
But there was a Greek community in Braila.
Yes, but I don't think that we were part of it. It is not as a family. My father actually had a lot of Greek friends because they went to the same schools together. He maintained them till very, very late when we came to Greece. I went to Wien to visit one of his old friends, actually, who was in Athens also. But for us, we were on the other side. I mean, I went to Romanian schools. I didn't go to Greek schools, and so did my brother.
Was your mother Romanian then?
She was part Romanian and part Greek. Yeah.
So you grew up speaking Romanian?
Mostly Romanian.
Greek?
Mostly Romanian. No, we didn't speak Greek. But because father was speaking to us sometimes in Greek and so on, I think we took it in, at least in terms of pronunciation and so on.
And French, I think, was
French was at school. Yeah, French was at school.
Yes. So at 16, the family left for...
We had to leave. You know, the Russians came in, so to speak, the communists, and we were there for a number of years. We were 3 or 4 years, actually. But then my father thought that we wouldn't be able to survive if we stayed. And so a large group of Greeks, actually, from Romania left because we all had passports. That was why we could come out of the country. Otherwise, you couldn't, yeah. So there was a large, I think something, the first group that we left with was around 1,000 people or something like this, yeah. It was still a very difficult issue, you know. Everything had closed down. You couldn't leave the country. Politically, it was rather difficult, the whole thing, and so on, yeah.
So your destination was...
Greece, of course.
Greece,
yeah,
a displaced persons camp.
Well, yeah, when we reached Greece, yeah.
When you reached Greece.
Well, I know we originally went and stayed with the family, but, you know, the family, Greece had gone through terrible issues during the war and so on and so forth. So it was a very difficult financial issue. And both my father, who played the violin, and my brother, who was going to the con, you know, needed space
played
to...
Played the cello.
Say, yeah, and of course the neighbor who didn't like it. And
Even in
so
Greece.
We left for the camp. That's a much easier. But then, of course, other problems were there. Yeah.
Yes. So how long were you in the camp for?
In the camp we were till 51, actually.
How old were you then, 51?
I was almost 20.
So 4 years,
yeah.
More or less,
yeah.
Yes. And so at the age of 20, the family migrated to New Zealand.
Yeah, we went to New Zealand, yeah.
And... how old? I'm sorry to keep asking your age.
This is not allowed, you know.
No, only your present
too
age.
Too much emphasis on age now.
No, I'm just trying to get a sense of the chronology of your development as a writer.
That development, There was not much development then, I have to tell you.
Well, were you writing already in Romania?
No, I kept some sort of diaries, but very, very small ones, minuscule ones, with some impressions in the camps. But no, not much actually. The only thing I wrote in Greece actually was that when we came, we went and saw this marvelous statue in the cemetery of a girl called the Sleeping One, Ichimomeni. And I wrote, actually, I was most impressed that the sculptor who did it had been in love with her, and she had died very, very young. So he made this sort of sketch. Halepas is the name of the sculptor. And so I wrote a little story about it. Yeah. Nothing to write home
that
about.
That was in Greece.
That was in
the
Greece.
camp,
yeah,
yes.
That was in Greece, yeah.
So effectively you started writing in New Zealand.
More or less, in a serious term, yeah. When I went to uni,
Yes.
yeah.
So there are two books from that time, or maybe not. The First Journey.
Ah, which I wrote later, yeah.
Ah, so they're
Not at
both
the time. At the time,
retrospective.
I wasn't. At the time, I actually began to. I wrote a number of short stories, which were published by Victoria University
Yes.
in one of the little magazines.
Right.
Yeah, but nothing very much. No, no.
So your publishing was basically in
Australia,
Australia. And so
yeah.
when did you come to Australia? How old were you then?
20, you fool. Why are you constantly asking me all this?
Ah, so you weren't in New Zealand for very long in that case.
No, I went there for 4 years.
4 years
So you
only.
turned,
Oh, I
yeah.
see. So I'm just thinking that in your writing, most of which occurred in Australia, obviously, those pasts, three pasts at least, tend to be overlaid.
Well, of course, yeah.
So that there's a sense that the past
Is a
from any,
continuum, yeah.
yes, and can erupt into the present with some force
Of
as
course,
well.
of course, of course. After all these experiences, were very powerful at the time, and you need a lot of energy to survive them, so to speak. So they
Yes.
remain in you even now, yeah.
So the pasts, that I think are strongest in your writing, obviously in your early writing, published in Australia, would be the New Zealand
Yeah, so,
past,
well, I mean,
the
some
island,
of the
and
island,
and the early poems as well in Alien in that collection, and they're very powerful. But they also seem informed by an aesthetic or a way of thinking about writing that comes from earlier, from the
Well, yes,
Romanian time, I think.
yeah, no, because in Romania we were very much into French culture.
Yes.
Romania was it was absolutely, parallel issues. So we read a lot of French literature, of course Russian, whatever, Italian, the whole, because it was a reading place, the house. My mother read very, very extensively, yeah, and was very interested actually in literature and of course in life, so to speak, and so on. So I had all this background from Romania. And then of course in Greece we didn't there was no space actually to be very much into literature and whatever. And at school actually we did some ancient texts, but on a very small scale with not much analysis of it and so
I was thinking particularly of the
on.
surrealist element in your writing,
Yeah.
the way in which certain images suddenly stand out of their context
Yeah.
with a force, with a strangeness,
Yeah.
or with a kind of portentous quality,
Yeah.
symbolic quality. But I can't imagine you getting that from New Zealand or
From New
Australia,
Zealand,
so I think that must have come earlier from the
no. It was,
Romanian
yes, but I was
education.
already a foreign person. I didn't. I came already well formed by the time I reached New Zealand. I
Yes.
had read a lot. I had seen some stuff. We had gone through terrible stuff as well as personal experiences and so on. So New Zealand was, sort of on top of all this, actually. Yeah.
And which was a very forceful experience in its own right,
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
clearly
of course.
judging by the writing about New Zealand. And then the fourth dislocation or to Australia.
Yeah. Australia was a very positive direction for me. Yeah. The climate, the heat, the distances, so many
Because it
ethnics.
was familiar, or because all of that was unfamiliar? I mean,
No,
your
totally
experience of the
unfamiliar.
heat was
Totally,
totally
no. I
unfamiliar,
came because
yes.
a friend from that we went to school together in Greece actually had migrated to Australia actually and married a Yugoslav that I also knew from Lavrion, from this small place that I was there. But it was much closer to earlier experiences than New Zealand. New Zealand, was very green and quite cold and a lot of rain.
Yes.
So I was not actually that. So it was a difficult thing to take on top of. whatever was happening to the family and so on and so forth. So no, New Zealand was Australia was a very, very positive experience.
Yes, I have a sense from your writing about New Zealand that you thought it was a very primitive place. Vegetative almost, in terms of its greenness and its fertility.
Well, it was a sort of probably Englishness, more English than the English. Yes. It had remained statically at some point, I assume, and so. But but they were very, they were quite nice people. They didn't actually attack or in any direct way or they were not nasty to us in any sort of way. Only that we were coming and we were in such a terrible position as the refugees, So we had no one there. And so everyone remained in the group then. We remained in the people that we came, a number of us, which were all had gone to school together in Greece and so on, remain as friends. We are still friends now. I still, I'm still in contact with them.
And it amazes me, on the face of it at any rate, how quickly you were accepted in Australia as a writer. I mean, one of your early patrons was PR Inky Stevenson, the publisher.
That's a story in itself. I don't think so.
It seems an unlikely coalition, I have to say. but nevertheless, he was...
Stevenson is, I sent the Adelaide Festival.
Yes.
And they were asking for prose works, yes. And I sent the prose work, which was, as usual, was too small to be a novel.
Of course, yes.
And too long to be a short story. So, I'm always falling by the wayside, all sorts of ways. And they gave me a little prize. They liked, actually, the story, which was, I've forgotten how long, 50 pages probably. It was quite long. At any rate, and they gave me a prize of, I've forgotten, 40... pounds or 50 pounds or something like this, and they were, they wrote in newspapers, that we had won this. I forgot the person who won the major prize for a novel. He has disappeared. I haven't seen him in the paper. But at any rate, here, yes. And
what
then
year was
Stevens
this?
Was an agent.
Yes, that's right.
And then when he saw the name and the paper, he immediately got in touch with me.
Right.
He wanted to publish the book.
It's such an extraordinary... coming together because,
come together.
He was the author of the foundation. I know. You almost came together.
But
he was the author of Foundations of Culture in Australia.
She just made a good...
He expressed an interest.
He expressed interest to publish me. But it wasn't, the person actually who... Now I have to remember the name. This is what I was trying to... This very, very lovely writer from South Australia, whose name escapes me now. He was the one actually that took up the book and wanted very much to publish it and wrote to the literary, to the camera, to ask for money. And no, they didn't give him any money. So he left it for a while and then he picked it up again, but nothing happened. Yeah.
Ian Moody. So this is interesting, I think, because your stance has been, one of really of an outsider in a sense, outside the normal established literary scene. And certainly those who were in that scene have treated you like an outsider. Nevertheless, in those early days, there was nothing there.
I was sending...
But Ian Moody and then Martin Jewell.
But Moody was for a while because it was connected to the Adelaide Festival and the actual thing. But then he disappeared. He had his own life.
So there wasn't building.
No, nothing to do.
Yeah. And Martin Jewell?
Martin Jewell came only because I went to the council. And that the council was Hall.
Rodney Hall.
Hall. Now, he was the one, actually, who recommended me to Jewell.
Right.
Yeah, and Martin was actually fighting as well because the people who were his board didn't want to publish me. So he had a lot of trouble actually publishing the small volume. That this is how it came, because of Rodney Hall. Yeah.
And then later it was Wild and Woolly, Michael Wilding.
I think they were starting the press.
Yes.
And they were looking for people to actually publish. And Pat Woolley actually was looking around who was there. So she approached Rudy, and then she approached me. And this is how we came into the Wild and Woolley business.
Yes, I think Wild and Woolley was quite remarkable because of its openness to other voices. They
Who
published
have,
Bio.
No,
they had a Pacific series as well, a Russian series as well. Yes.
No would have published me at the time. I mean, you know, Pat has been absolutely marvelous and continue to be, actually.
And then there was Hale and Ironmonger, a great press.
Oh, they were very lovely. They were very,
Sylvia
very
Hale, and that was with The Island, wasn't it?
And the poetry, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, and the poetry as well, and then Giramondo, I suppose.
And then you
so,
came.
I mean, you know, looking at you know, the works you've done and your publishing history, it's rich, you know, and it's continuous in a way, despite the difficulties.
It didn't feel so much from inside, you know.
No, I know. And the reception was always,
the reception was always,
I mean, an incompreehension, really. Yeah. And
they are not used to the style, to the approaches, things that I was saying. I was not into a real reality, so to speak, according to whatever.
So
too
I think,
short.
Yes. Well, we'll come back to a brief, well, I think a minimalism, I would call it. I think this was an issue. But I think the immediacy with which you experienced time was also an issue. I mean, the sense of historical circumstance, the weight of time, the way in which it kind of intrudes into the presence in such a way. And also some of your poetic effects, which are related to the experience of time, like the use of synesthesia, you know, the air
Not
turns
that
to
I was
stone.
Aware of them.
And you weren't? Stone turns liquid, you know, there's a kind of crossing of the senses. I assume that, you know, to some extent that derives from a surrealist tradition.
Yeah.
But it's a very sensual, very sensory kind of poetry. So let's have a look at the minimalism first. I think a lot of people read the poems, say, is that all there is, sort of thing? Because they're really more than a page, two pages, or a sequence, might go longer. And, you know, one has a strong sense of them being carved out and polished again and reduced in the process to a kind of essential entity, an essential linguistic entity. I think what comes through most for me is the solidity of the language, or the, maybe not solidity, but the presence of the language, the weight of the language. Do you want to, I mean, I know you've written about this, about the weight of the language, in Alexia, for example.
But also you have to think that I came to English as a foreign language.
Yes.
I was not in the language from the beginning.
Yes.
Therefore, I was constantly translating to a certain extent issues which are probably outside the language as well, in the terms that I was translating them, as well as my past. So you are dealing with a double issue. I was telling you early on, actually, that I found a sort of a number of responses to languages and so on, and other writers who are actually playing with forms, a thing that I have never been able to do, actually, And I found this note, actually, something written 20 years ago, in which I was saying that for me, actually, language is a sort of magical issue, that you have to be very, very careful how you deal with it, because it has enormous power for you and for others, hopefully, and so on. So it is another approach, actually, to language as well, from what is on the market now, in which people are using it as a method of actually playing with it and trying out issues, or going for 19th century forms, or something which I have never done,
I just want to come back to this idea of your sense of the language having come to it as a second language, or a third language, actually. I mean, I think the common assumption, which I've heard critics say, is that you don't speak, you know, you don't write English properly, as if writing in a second language was somehow a disqualification, or an impairment, a disability, That your use of the language would be accented, possibly ungrammatical.
You challenge the fact that you are not quite in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whereas it seems to me that, you know the language really well, all the more for coming into it as a created entity, if you like. And that when you do play with grammar and with the sound of words, it's quite deliberate. I remember your use of the word orb. One, just that word on a whole line, you know, orb, and you have to kind
knocked
of...
Knocked you out,
the reader has to kind of... what was the line again? It was about Queen Victoria, wasn't it?
Yes, but this is... yes, you are. But it's a powerful... I mean, I feel that people no longer go back to the language as a very powerful element. And no one actually talks about it in these terms. So, you know, they don't seem to be aware, actually, of the potency of the issue.
No, I agree. Yeah. There's another poem, I think it's called Beer Garden. Where you talk about, about this, the heat, about... people in the beer garden sizzling, and it's—I think it's just that one word on the line
which places you. You
have to attenuate it, you know, because the other lines are three or four words on it. So you have to say, you're forced to say sizzling.
And when I can, you read it, when
yes,
you read it,
and I can hear you saying it, and I think that's a wonderful discipline to impose on the reader. Really. Uncompromising, you know, you have to read it this way. Can I just read you something from Sydney Journals about language? In my case, I don't feel that words clutter me. On the contrary, I feel that I have to recreate them with difficulty out of thin air, so to speak. Their nature always too self-contained, too well-defined, as if stone presences that constantly demand their singular places, demand that one should acknowledge their individual existence in relation to a meaning. Do you want to just elaborate on that a little bit or clarify this sense of the words is already made in a sense?
You are already dealing with actually a defined both form and meanings which are coming within English, you know, for a very long way off, shall I say, centuries of utilization and so on. So when you come to it, it is already a system, so to speak, to a certain extent. And if you intend to put something else there, which is not in the language already, or if you feel the other issue, I think that I think most writers are trying to do that, is actually come out of the language into some other field and say something which is depends on words, but at the same time escapes the narrow nature sometimes of the issue and makes points which are much more probably difficult to think of before and so on, and gives you another perspective of the language which is outside the thing but nevertheless through the language. So this is always, I think, it's a difficult thing for writers to come out of this thing that you are using and try to express some things which are rising out of it in some
way. So are you talking about implication? Resonance, association.
Yes, association, the feeling of it, the colouring.
Colouring is important.
Colouring,
for you,
yes. The
texture.
Visual issues that are coming out of it and things of that nature. When you try to express something, you feel sometimes. Well, sometimes you know that you go with the language and it's okay, but sometimes you have to fight it. Which is not very good, actually, fighting a language.
Wrestling. What about wrestling?
Wrestling. No, that's too...
too physical, too masculine.
We don't want to wrestle. No.
But you do give the sense of the language coming to you formed in some way and then requiring on your part considerable strength in the mobilization of the words and of their resonances and implications as well. And certainly my sense of the poems is of, an extraordinary discipline in the writing anyway to achieve that kind of power from a very minimal means.
I'm not that aware of all this. I mean, I am aware and not aware of all these things, actually.
Really?
What it is, I think people are asking me, you are thinking of the same topics for a very long time. You actually live, with directions in yourself for a very long time before these things actually come out in any expressed form.
It's just, I think of you in your in your writing room.
Yeah, yeah.
which looks very much like a cell,
a cave, or a monastic cell.
Yeah. And I think of you in there, engaged in the kind of ascetic, ascetic routine. And certainly, there is an element of asceticism in your writing, in the sense that you avoid adverbs and adjectives, there's an avoidance generally of rhetorical flourishes. And
I have a friend who, Franco, who is against adjectives.
Adjectives, yeah. Well, you must have learnt some things from him. I mean, it is, yeah. I think if you engaged in the discipline of writing.
Yeah, for sure. You have to, otherwise how can you? Yeah, there is no way out.
As if it was a craft.
There is no way out. Yeah, you have to work at it. Yeah, again and again and again. You know, to write a poem of 10 lines, I sometimes produce something like 150 copies.
Really?
Yeah.
And this is on a typewriter, not on a word processor. There's 150 physical page versions of it.
Yes. On and on and on. No, a word was absolutely not right there. You were going down. Another, the third word, on and on and on and on and on to try. Well, I don't know. I assume that you develop, because you were working at it for so long, you develop a sort of ear that tells you what is adequate, what works in something, what doesn't work. And you constantly try to find, you know, the thing that actually works. For you, at any rate, you don't know whether it will work for anyone else. I mean, it's all a question of whatever, a relative question, as always.
So it's sound, obviously, but it's also...
It's tone, it's visual, it's, I don't know. Association. Yes, an entire combination. And depending on
and
what
rhythm
you want to
too,
express.
I think.
What you want to express.
So I presume that, you know, with those 150 versions, it gets smaller and smaller? Does it start large and then get smaller and smaller?
Sometimes I used to keep them for a while, actually, because sometimes what I threw out was quite good and I could use it back again.
So, yes.
You know, I went back to the whole thing.
But it's not a reductive process necessarily, is it?
No. I don't write a lot and then come down.
No.
I think that the size of it from the beginning, it's always small.
It's a moment. This relates to, you know, your sense of time, the sense of time in your poems. Yeah. They're moments which can expand out. I'm very struck by the predominance of dreams in both your poems and the journals. I get the impression that you have a very active dream life. But also it's a literary device, I think, for bringing in, you know, the supernatural or the mysterious, anxiety, deep-seated memories.
I know. I think it's a much more ordinary part of life, actually. I don't think that I bring... because I dream a lot. And then if you notice, I mean, a lot of writers actually dream and are using dreams, actually, in their writings and so on, And obviously a method of coming to some other understanding of everyday events or your own anxieties or whatever, into some sort of surreal element.
I was interested because I don't dream a lot myself.
I
dream and I suppress them, but I certainly don't remember them.
Yeah.
So the idea of an active dream life...
Some of it is so powerful, actually, that... You don't want to remember it, especially if it's negative.
Yes.
No. Yes. It's very visual as well,
And it's the past coming back, you know, often in...
Whatever, even everyday issues or whatever, Well, I can't remember. I mean, it was just a normal part of issues. It isn't anything...
You note the dreams in your journals.
Yes, especially if they are... Some of them are very powerful, actually.
And so then they become the material.
Yeah, they become the material. Part of the journals,
So I did want to talk to you because we've been talking about the poetry, but you're equally a prose writer and your journals and your novellas are as distinctive and as powerful as your poetry. Is that a different discipline? Do you see a continuity? Because we don't have many writers in Australia who are both poets and prose writers.
Yes, well, I don't know how it happens, actually. There are topics that can only go into poetry, and others that can only go into prose. And sometimes it's the same subject matter at any rate, because you can trace things that I have written about in poetry that come into the thing in a much wider, in a wider sense.
And
because
images.
You have language is much more expansive in terms of prose. But I am not forcing it or deciding it or doing anything. It seems to come inwardly into one form or another.
There's some flexibility in your mind as to what the form is exactly. I remember when we published the three early journals in Summer Visit,
yeah.
And I think you insisted on the subtitle Three Novellas.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were actually, a combination of journal entries.
No, these are not. Like the others. Like the journey, first journey and one.
But subsequently, you then moved into the journal form. So that suggests, and I've seen the journal, it's quite an extraordinary. Several shelves from what since the 1970s for the last 50 years almost
not quite 50 but then
close
30 probably
yeah or 30 yeah. So that means you're constantly writing in effect as opposed to my image of you in the cell in the monastic. There's this other image of you as constantly noting things down and observing, taking notes on your reading, on performances life, you've been to, gallery, exhibitions, friendships, lives, deaths, births, a whole kind of panorama of life in Sydney, really.
What originally, originally I thought, because I had to work all the time when I came to Australia, there was no time to write. And I had begun in New Zealand, actually, to have some sort of discipline in this direction. So I was going to work, five days a week and was writing things in the weekend. But this actually, the journals became a sort of method of talking about my life to myself. What was happening and what I had seen and I don't know what, keeping a sort of tag on what was going on because I had to deal with other issues at the office and so on. And then there was life, whatever, family, whatever. So it was a sort of I don't know how to express it, putting down an everyday, shall I say, with whatever it went. And now, in retrospect, when I look at some of the entries, I would not have remembered them at all.
No.
It's amazing how little, actually, memory we have, actually, of everyday issues or their importance, unless they are so major that they become, inwardly a thing that you have to look at it for many, many years to come. But this minor, things you don't remember very well, or the actual coloring of them, or immediate impressions, or whatever. So I find it very, very good, I have to say. I still do it now. I'm writing nonsense now because I finished, the thing, and I am very, very tired inwardly, actually. So I haven't started to. I don't know whether I shall write again. We'll see what will happen. But I still write,
But it seems to me, I'm interested in your method of composition here too. In a way, you come to the journal, I presume, Sydney journals, for example, but they're highly composed.
Oh, yes.
And I remember,
you have only, they are cut up, edited,
yeah,
and I don't know what.
Right.
Yes, you're not getting there.
And I remember a notable Australian academic critic criticizing
you
for putting things in the wrong order and all that. Because
yeah.
They're composed by the seasons, summer, right through to summer again. And he didn't like the fact that instead of giving names, you gave initials, as if, you ethnics, you're constantly withholding things, you're not really letting us know what you think, The suspicion was huge.
Yeah.
And, the idea that you might have been playing with chronology or at least composing what he's supposed to be a spontaneous form was enraged him, really. So I just... To me, that's fine. It's a form. It's a literary form, the journal. And one assumes that. But it sounds like, how do you operate? Do you just pick up a journal from the shelf and look in it for material? Or do you know where things are, roughly? Do you work according to the year or the season? Could you take, you know, an element from, you know, 1975 and another one from 30 years later?
But I actually went through the, when I decided to actually, I mean, I started with you because you published the first one in your magazine.
Heat.
And to a certain extent, to give some negative points about myself, is that I could no longer probably write prose in a much more creative way, like I had done with the first journey and with I don't know what. And so all this material was there, which I thought maybe I can do something with it. And what was good about it was what already there was a form to it. I did not have to create the form, actually, or the subject matter. You know, everything was there. The only thing I had to do is make some choices and do a little bit of editing, and I had a book.
Well, I think you're being a little ungenerous to yourself.
I don't think so.
What I was going to say was that it struck me that you come to that material in the way that you come to language for the poems, that they're sort of fragments, if you like,
of
memory, even to the point where they no longer seem to be your memories particularly, but something remembered. So they have a life of their own. Well, they must have been written originally with a poetic eye because they survived. They're not just what the weather was on a particular day. So they have a solidity of their own, which can then, I keep coming back to a kind of sculptural metaphor, but that you can then sculpt, polish.
But I didn't know, actually, because there were not very many journals in Australian literature.
No,
I know. But now they are coming up.
Well, this is
even
the interesting thing.
Murray has come, whatever his name is.
Yeah, Les, Murray Bale,
Bale. Yes, and Gardner, of course, the second one, which I haven't looked at yet.
And so before her, Beverly Farmer, Body of Water. So it's a recent phenomenon.
It's a recent,
I think you were actually doing it before any of them.
Yeah.
I'm sure I remember Beverly telling me that she was influenced by your journals, and certainly Helen was because we sent them to her. So I think that's an area in which you've had a decisive influence on Australian writing.
Well, I think it'll come now because all of us are growing older and probably we have kept notes.
Well,
which will come up. You will be dealing with this now for some time.
Yes, now there's a younger generation of writers who've come up in a similar way through journal writing, but, you know, through blogs or zines.
Ah, yes, probably,
Or on the net in some form or another. I think it is having an effect on Australian writing.
But it's good. I mean, it implies a certain analysis of your life, of your attitudes, of the attitudes of other people, of some ethical issues, I assume, or social mores, and I don't know what. I mean, so you actually are working a field in which you are living, actually, with other people and so on. So I think it's a very, very good, actually.
This is the amazing thing I did want to talk to you about, finally. You know, there is this sense of you as a solitary writer, both because of the extraordinary discipline of your writing, but because of also, I think, of this outsider status which is partly a result of the establishment treating you as a foreigner. But partly also, I think, a role that you've taken on yourself. It gives you a kind of standpoint, and, you know, some of your writing is ironic. Viciously ironic. So, you know,
and satirical. I don't think anyone has seen that.
No one has actually said anything
about my irony.
But it's very, very strong, satirical, especially against figures who have power, whether institutional power or power as, you know, celebrity writers. So I think it's partly a role you've cultivated. But what strikes me, given that sense of you as an outsider, is how social the journals are, how full they are of the detail of living in Sydney and also of your travels.
Well, with friends, and everything else. I mean, and also Australia. I was looking actually the other day, this program on SBS actually, the Aboriginal program actually about Lake Mungo. They did an entire issue on Lake Mungo and how they found the lady, you know, And I went with Yolanda, yes. And Jörg is there. So
and that's in the journals, too. Yes, a wonderful description.
Yeah, so I was looking at it, and the Aboriginal people, of course, were in there and were talking about it in the past and whatever.
That's always an interesting aspect of your journals the meeting between the migrant and the Aboriginal. That, I think, is another classic aspect. You know, a strong sense of community, which is interesting. I mean, your use of the, you know, Murray Bale uses the third person, but you always use the first and the first person singular, but mainly the first person plural, we. So there's a strong sense of community there.
Well, I was actually thinking about it because you are constantly harping on this we.
Yeah, I know. The royal plural, as you say.
Every time you meet me, why are you using we?
Yes.
And I was thinking what it is, actually. When we were in Romania, we were a family made of individuals.
Yes.
We were, each one of us, you know, had whatever. They were doing something or other. And then the family was coming together. But the moment, actually, we were forced to leave and become refugees, you are automatically outside and never considered as part of a group.
Right.
You were a refugee. You are no longer you as an individual, but always
you were
declassé, using a plural.
Yeah,
you were actually in a plural situation. And when I began writing, I felt that all of us were actually, all the refugees, known or unknown, were actually, we are moving in the same sort of direction, trying to deal with the same situation and maybe feeling the same thing that I was feeling. So I think this is why I came to the we business that you always find.
Yeah, well, it's an expression of a sense of community.
Yeah.
And I think just about everybody that's understood by the we.
Yeah.
No, not everybody, because there are important figures like Elizabeth Harrower, Patricia.
Oh, yes, so,
who weren't immigrants
or
refugees.
But they were not refugees.
No, they weren't refugees. But so there is an intellectual fellowship as well. And a writers and so on.
And at the time that Elizabeth was writing, she did not feel very much.
No,
there was a fellowship
for her
at any rate.
Exactly,
I think later when Patrick White came, others, I don't know what, but she was no longer writing. So at the time she was alone with these immense problems that she was writing about.
It's a bit like a Salon des Refusés, in a way. But a very proud one. So I think that's one of your great achievements as a writer, unexpected in a way, that you should be a chronicler of Sydney, especially of life, over a period of 30 years. Mm-hmm. Very rich, a kind of Samuel Pepys of who would have thought?
the one who's the
immigrant, the one who's the outsider.
But it's always the case. If you actually look, for instance, at the attitude to Australia and Australian issues, you will find a lot of outsiders actually are the ones that are picking up a lot of this stuff, more than the locals, because the locals, for them, is just an everyday business, while the people from outside feel it as something, exciting or new or I don't know what.
I'm impressed by the journals, both in literary terms as a form, because of the way you handle the moments. I'm interested in late work. I don't know if this is a distinction that will appeal to you, but does writing age, or is it ageless? Do you know what I mean? I'm not talking about, something you wrote 30 years ago, has it aged since then? No, not at all. What you wrote is still timeless in a way. But as a writer, do you feel your writing changes with age?
Well, it must of necessity. But I know that I'm aware of it myself, I have to say. This is what you have to consider, that a lot of the things that are coming in writing are actually beyond your capacity to analyze or to place or to demand of your inner self that you go in that direction or whatever. They come. There is a development that goes on in spite of you or whatever, in whatever. And obviously, the fact that I have gone through all this and have seen life in general and things that have happened and tragedies. And now, of course, a lot of my friends are dying and whatever. This, to a certain extent, has to make an impact on the writing. But I'm trying not to make it too sad.
The obvious features that you would expect, of writing, like, preoccupation with death and a certain brevity, because energy is depleted, so, you go for the shorter form.
Yeah.
But you were doing that from the beginning.
In my case, I was a short form before.
And there was the preoccupation with death.
So. Maybe I shall come in vogue now.
Yeah,
that,
well,
that death seems to be coming into Australian consciousness. They say, oh, Antigone was writing about it a long time.
That's right. But in a way, you're inoculated against the prospect.
Well, and so, not really. You're never inoculated. This is not a topic that anyone gets inoculated.
Antigone, we've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about
that you'd like to discuss?
We've covered
everything. Yes. No, I can't complain. I have to say that even though I complained at the beginning that it was so difficult actually to publish anything,
that
people constantly spoke of my foreignness at any rate, my language improbability, and so on and so forth. Well, that's what it is, actually. So, I mean, I'm not... whoever likes it will like it, and whoever doesn't, and what can we say about it?
I mean, I feel upset that, you know, you've never been given a grant, for example, that you haven't been recognized, and that it was only very late, only 2 years ago or two or three years ago, that you were recognized with a major prize, and that was the Judith Wright Calanthe Award, which I regard as the top poetry prize in the country. So
she would be surprised, I think.
You do? But she could be very brief. Her lyrics
are
very...
I'm not sure about that.
Did you ever have an encounter with her?
Yes. I sent her poetry
Judith Wright,
at one time. Judith Wright, I actually sent the what became my first prose work, actually. And, she was rather hush.
Really?
And she wrote me. Well, she read it, poor thing. She had to read so many things.
Was she an editor at that point?
No, I don't. No. I wrote to Patrick White, because I felt so lonely within the Australian literary scene. You know, I had no contact apart from immediate friends, whatever. But not generally speaking, there was no one there, more or less. So I wrote to Patrick White, and he actually wrote to me and said, don't worry, it happens to all of us.
You have to go on writing. It's true enough. So he was nice.
He was nice,
And did you meet him later?
Manoli, I think probably they knew I was on the market
connection.
And so on.
The Greek connection.
But with Judith Wright, actually, I sent her the prose work, and she was very harsh on it. She said to me that for something like this to survive, this must be very well written. And obviously, this was not the case and so on. I think later, when I met her publicly, she was slightly apologetic for actually that she had been slightly harsh on me.
Condescending.
And I think by then, because I knew Dr. Coombs from the Australia Council.
Yeah.
He was our boss. And he liked my poetry. He always, every time we gave him what was published in the papers, and he would always write very good or something
good
like
on
this.
Him. Good on him.
He was very, very nice. I mean, the arts in Australia should, build him a statue, I think. Nothing would have happened without him. He was the one, I think, that argued with the government to actually produce this legislation. No one was interested in the arts. I mean, we see it now, apart from Whitlam. We see it now, actually, what is happening.
Well, Antigone, I think we should end there. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Mm. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you. The voice. At the sound, I turned. My veins full of ice that traveled at high speed, releasing fire. This return... The past attacking unexpectedly in the familiar streets. Patricia. Her eyes, the blue of ceramics in the candlelight, blue-green gems full of fire. On stage, this exquisite light from a secret source floating out of her, with her, rising. The neighbor. On Monday, she said, they took her away. On Tuesday, the dog was put down. On Wednesday, the furniture went. And poor Bob, still at the resting home, that nice place, the walls white, the bed covers red, and he sitting there in his pajamas, drinking tea, unaware of the maple coffin, and she lying dead, and all the lovely flowers. Summer at Derveni. We sink in light, disappear in the silence, nothing but the slow folding of the sea. Afternoon heat empty of voices, on the foil surface heads drifting like heavy ornaments. At dusk the fishing boats, massive dark stones planted in a field of moonstone. Day by day, another spring, the peach tree in flower again, unerringly. On the lawns, their neck feathers green, shimmering in the sunlight, the pigeons coo, restless, assiduously tapping the earth. Backwards we turn backwards, measure our failures with infinite patience, reimagine the times.